Now 36 degrees.
A game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In balmy Arizona, where the football weather's hot, two teams contended to resolve which is and which is not the number one team in the land beyond all disputation. And so today, thanks to the BCS, in all the nation there is just one lone number one atop the football heap, unless you think the BCS deal should be put to sleep. Nobody in Ohio is feeling that way. After two overtimes, it was Ohio State 31, Miami 24 last night in Tempe. Ohio State's first championship in 34 years convinced Buckeye fans that the BCS system works splendidly. Meanwhile, for fans who couldn't manage to find a ticket to the Fiesta Bowl, there were, as Mark Moran of member station KJZZ in Phoenix reports, a few other opportunities to share in the fun.
And the kick is good by Todd Sievers, and it is now a three-point lead for the Ohio State Buckeyes.
Last night's game started about 6 p.m. local time, but the event surrounding it started way back in August when Jenny Rimzo, who curiously enough has the same last name as Phoenix's mayor, was crowned Fiesta Bowl queen. If you didn't make the August beauty pageant, there were plenty more opportunities for Fiesta-related fun. A running race, golf, basketball, soccer, and volleyball tournaments, and the Twirl, Palm, Cheer, Flag, and Dance Championships. But by December 8th, two worthy opponents accepted invitations, and the events got serious. For $10, you could have attended Sunday's National Band Championship. For a dozen high school marching bands, that was far more important than some college football game. Just ask 16-year-old Diane Walden from the Pride of Broken Arrow, Oklahoma band.
Do you care about the Fiesta Bowl game itself?
Kind of. Not really.
Do you know who's playing in the game?
Isn't it like Miami and somebody else?
If you're not into watching marching bands, you had a chance to be one of the 400,000 people at Tuesday's Fiesta Bowl parade. Fiesta Board Chairman Steve Horrell introduced the Grand Marshal at a press conference.
Obviously, this guy needs no introduction, but just two words, Cal Ripken. Cal, take it away.
Well, I'm pretty perplexed because I didn't go to college and I didn't play football.
That's all right.
Ripken is a man who clearly is more comfortable setting baseball's consecutive games record than waving from a convertible Mustang.
I asked for some suggestions in the next room about what my wave should be. I mean, this one seems kind of goofy to act for me to actually do that. I figured maybe something like this or maybe a thumbs up or the double hands like that. I'm not sure.
For those not seated in the official convertible, there were two choices. You could find a free spot near the starting line, or for $25 you could buy a spot along the parade route. A bargain for Mary Hickey and her friends, Ohio State alumni decked out in scarlet and gray.
Their bleacher seats, I think we're high up in the bleachers, like the second row from the top, so it looks like we'll have a great view.
Good. Anything else you want to add?
Go Bucks! We're all from Ohio, even though we live in different places now.
If that still wasn't enough entertainment for one day, for $15 you could have taken part in the 18th annual Tempe Tostitos Fiesta Bowl Block Party. And if that still wasn't enough, $15 more would have gotten you into yesterday's college football's greatest party. All told, the Fiesta Bowl and the events surrounding it will generate about $140 million for Phoenix area businesses. Board Chairman Steve Horrell says when the Fiesta Bowl was founded in 1971, the events were actually more important than the game itself, which was designed for the Arizona State University Sun Devils to get some attention from the Eastern media. He notes that, amazingly, there are actually fewer events now than there used to be.
At one time, we had almost 80 or 90 events throughout the valley throughout the year, from marathons to duck races to including the parade and the band championships and all that.
It's hard to imagine, but even with the Fiesta Bowl's new austerity program, allowing about half that many events, each team stands to take about $13.5 million back to their conference. And there's still one more chance for fans to take part in the Fiesta Bowl celebration on Thursday during the Eddie Robinson Coach of the Year banquet. For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Tempe, Arizona.
Next week, a panel established to evaluate Title IX, the law that requires gender equity in college sports, will offer recommendations regarding the interpretation and enforcement of that law. Joining me now is Julie Foudy, captain of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and a member of the Commission on Opportunity and Athletics. Julie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Since August, the Commission has been hearing testimony from a number of athletic directors and athletes, many of whom want changes made to the way Title IX is interpreted and enforced. What are some of the problems schools are having meeting the requirements of Title IX?
You have a few days for this one. Actually, one of the things that, you know, we keep hearing over and over in a series of town hall meetings was that there needs to be better education out there about what the three prongs are to Title IX, because a lot of people don't understand the nuances of it, including even, you know, athletic directors and people who are making these decisions on programs. So mm-hmm. a lot of people know what the proportionality prong is, of course, because that gets most of the attention and criticism. But there's also two other prongs that a lot of people don't know about in terms of ways you can comply.
The commission was established at least in part to respond to a lawsuit filed by the National Wrestling Coaches Association, and that suit contends that Title IX, as it has been applied, has been unfair to male athletes, forcing universities to cut men's programs in order to achieve gender equity. Has responding to that charge been the main concern of the commission?
Well, we've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence from, you know, wrestlers and gymnasts and other minor men's sports that have lost programs, and unfortunately, many of them blame Title IX, and that's one of the problems we've tried to look at on the commission. Is you have a finite budget at a lot of these schools, and they're trying to provide opportunities for women. And right now, what we'd love to see, and it's probably not the task of this commission, but hopefully we can recommend it, is that, you know, universities as a whole and the NCAA as a whole starts looking at their expenditure issue, because it's, you know, every college president and an athletic director will tell you it's a little bit out of control, out of control at the Division I-A level. And, you know, if one school is chartering planes, then we need to charter planes, and if they're staying in hotels, then we need to keep up with that recruiting race. And, you know, as a consequence, you lose a lot of the men's minor sports, and Title IX gets blamed for it. And you have some athletic directors, the San Diego State athletic director said, you know, it wasn't Title IX, it's the fact that I didn't want to touch my football budget, and I'd rather get rid of another sport. It's easier to do. So,
is that business, though, about the arms race, is that part of the concern of the commission, or is that kind of beyond your charge?
I think that's beyond our charge, but I think, you know, hopefully what will come out is a recommendation, and the Knights Commission as well made a recommendation. And you know, the issue is you have this finite pie, and no one's saying they don't love football and they don't love basketball, but there comes a point where what are college athletics for? Is it to provide opportunities for kids to actually compete, or is it to be a big business where you're making lots of money? And I think there's a balance between the two.
A number of the proposals that the commission is considering would weaken the proportionality requirement in Title IX, giving schools more of an opportunity to, among other things, allow for male non-scholarship walk-ons. But you have gone on record as saying the proposed variances in proportionality would be too extreme. Why is that?
Well, right now, one of the problems that the commissioners keep hearing is the language for the proportionality prong. The prong one says that a school has to be substantially proportionate. And so all the schools are like, well, what is substantially? And when the Office of Civil Rights tries to define it, they say, well, there's really not a definition for it because each school is different. And so, you know, most schools say it's between 1% and 3% for substantially proportionate. And what a lot of the commissioners are proposing, and a lot of them are from Division I-A schools, is let's put it at 7% was what some people said. And that would actually create like a 14% variance, which, mm-hmm. you know, gets you way off the spirit of Title IX. And I did go on record saying that, you know, this is a civil rights law that was created, and it's just not about prong one. There's two other prongs. And what I'm saying is you cannot weaken the spirit of this law, because unfortunately right now you still have schools who, depending on where you set that variance, say you set it at 7%. So if you had an equal student body, you'd have 43% women and 57% men participating if you set a 7% variance. And I'm saying right now you're going to have schools that will get to whatever the minimum requirement is for women.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of giving them opportunities, and that's a huge difference from where we're at right now.
The commission has heard some arguments for change. For example, the school that saw two of its female swimmers quit the team in the morning and then had to cut two men from the program in the afternoon to achieve equality. Is there any way to approach a solution to that problem?
Well, I definitely think that the idea behind it is let's provide opportunity for everyone, you know, and the intention of Title IX isn't to cut men and or men's sports. And so I've gotten to talk to a lot of civil rights experts who, you know, author this law, Norma Cantu and Val Bennett, and who worked in the Office of Civil Rights. And the experts are saying, you know, people need to better understand the law and understand what you can do with it, because it is very flexible. And it's that flexibility which actually causes confusion, because they try to design it to allow schools to be able to, you know, not have the government dictate to them what they should do. It's designed so the schools can say, this is what we want to do in terms of becoming compliant. So I definitely agree that there needs to be better clarity in different issues.
What's your best guess as far as the result of the commission's efforts?
You know, I don't know, Bill. We haven't even seen a draft of the report yet, and you know, everyone's been stuck in the holidays. And hopefully, we can come to some conclusions and agreement that, you know, there needs to be clarity and there needs to be educational materials out there to help people understand the law better. But at the same time, you know, we're not weakening our commitment to providing opportunities to young girls, because there's a lot of young girls that still want to play, and I would hate to see us do anything that would jeopardize their future.
Are you worried that the future of those athletes will be jeopardized?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so not yet. When we get to draft, then let's talk again.
Julie Foudy is a founding member of the WUSA and a member of the Commission on Opportunity in Athletics. Julie, thank you very much for speaking with
me.
No
problem, Bill. Happy New Year.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Roadhog!
Having forgotten their glasses when they started out on a 50-mile run in South Yorkshire, Barry Bedford and Les Huxley strayed all the way to Nottinghamshire. Unable to read either the road signs or the maps with which they'd been furnished, Bedford and Huxley spent 18 hours running in circles. At one point, a sympathetic observer pointed out to the pair that part of their problem might be that they were holding their map upside down. In all, Bedford and Huxley covered 70 rather than 50 miles and did not arrive at the finish line until 1:30 in the morning, at which point they called race organizers and asked for a lift home. "It was all our fault," Mr. Bedford said.
Oh, Magoo, you've done it again.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For the latest sports headlines, go to WBUR.org, click on News, then Sports. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Johnson Drugs in Waltham, a health and wellness pharmacy providing care with personal attention, offering an integration of mainstream and complementary medicine. The Boston Early Music Festival, presenting Boston's own Church of the Advent Choir, performing 16th-century sacred folkal music, on the web at bemf.org. And Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks worldwide for more than 14 years. Details at sophos.com. The weather forecast calling for snow, sleet, and rain ending later this morning. Snow possible this afternoon. Additional accumulation of 1 to 2 inches possible in the city, up to 4 additional inches north and west of the city. Just about all rain on Cape Cod and the islands. It'll be windy today, and a coastal flood warning is in effect for tides about 2.5 feet above normal at midday today. It's 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, our analyst and sports writer of the year, Charlie Pierce. But first, editor Glenn Stout presides annually over the Houghton Mifflin collection of the best American sports writing. He joins me now in the studio, as he does each year at about this time. Glenn, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And present by phone from Miami Beach is the writer whose piece occupies the coveted leadoff position in the current collection, Bill Plaschke of the Los Angeles Times. Bill, thank you for joining us.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Your piece about Sarah Morris, Bill, a young woman who might almost literally have nothing if she didn't have the Los Angeles Dodgers, is quite remarkable. Tell us a little bit about how you came to that story.
I've been doing this sports writing gig about 25 years. I've never seen anything like it. You know, I was reading through my email one winter day, and I get about 200 email a day from readers. And for some reason, I don't know why, but I happened to click on an email, which was just trashing me for some of my Dodger coverage, just saying I was an idiot and a fool. And, of course, again, of my 200 email, usually about half of those are like that. So I didn't think much of it. And I kept reading it, and then I realized it was such a informed email, and it had stats and stuff to back it up. But anyway, I started this correspondence with this woman. Finally, I say to her, you ought to be a sports writer, or you ought to do this. And I kept trying to give her encouragement. In one of the emails, she would say, well, you know, I can't really be a sports writer because I'm not very mobile. And I said, well, I wrote back and said, well, I'm kind of out of shape too, so what's the big deal? There's a lot of guys who are sports writers who aren't very mobile. And then she wrote back and said, no, you know, you don't understand. I can't walk. And I thought, well, you're paralyzed. I've seen sports writers in wheelchairs all the time. And she wrote back and she said, well, no, I can't use my arms either. She goes, I've got no function below my neck. And then I started to say, wait a minute. And so then I started to think that maybe I was being led on here and that this was like a joke.
A hoax or something.
A hoax, absolutely a hoax. I thought it was a hoax. Finally, you know, I said, well, fine, if you have no feeling below your neck, how are you typing this email? And she writes back and says, with my head. I said, okay, how long does it take you to send all these emails? And she sent back an email consisting of two paragraphs, and she said, this email took me 4 hours. And I about fell out of my chair, and I'm thinking, this person is really going far in this hoax. So I said, fine, I've got to talk to you. If this is true, if this is somebody writing, trying to be a sports writer and they knows about sports and ties with the head, I want to talk to you. And she writes back and she says, I can't talk. I've got cerebral palsy and I've never been able to talk. And so I sent her back an email saying, I want to come see you. And she says, you can't do that. And I said, well, that's it then. Forget it. My friends were right. You were lying. And she says, okay, fine. If you must come. She goes, I live in a very small town in Texas. The other hook for my story was that this woman wrote for a website. She wanted to be a sports writer. She had her own website.
Mm-hmm.
She said she had one hit every 2 months on the website.
Wow.
She claimed she wrote Dodger game stories, and once every 2 months somebody would read those Dodger game stories. She wrote them with her head watching TV. So I got my car and drove over countless dusty roads and back roads and up the dirt potholed road, and then finally I see this little tin shack, and I thought it was like an outhouse or a barn or something. And I look, and there's wheelchairs in front of the shack. And I say, oh, my God, this must be the place. And I walk into the house, and I about fell over. Indeed, there was such a person as Sarah Morris. Indeed, she typed stories with her head. She was a 80-pound, shriveled-up 30-year-old woman wearing a bonnet because she has no hair, curled up in a wheelchair, waiting for me. And the house was a little shack with rats running around and holes in the walls and broken windows and dust. She was dirt poor, unable to talk. Also, you know, she couldn't talk, so she would bark to me and her mom would translate. She'd go up, and her mom would say, hi Bill, how you doing? This is what her mom would stand behind her and translate.
Wow.
And I was just shaking in my boots. I was so ashamed that I had not believed her, and I was nauseous, because it was such an incredible scene. She was, you know, in all these years I've covered sports, you get so jaded, and then I see her doing this, and I say, this is what sports can do. It can keep a person alive. It can connect a person to the rest of the world, even if the rest of the world has no idea about this person.
Well, that's kind of my question. Once the story appeared in the L.A. Times, did readers connect with Sarah Morris's website?
Yeah, I wrote the story, and personally, me, I got the most email I've ever gotten in my life. I got 2,000 email for one story. Her website got 5,000 hits a day. It was overwhelming. People saw the story, and it touched a nerve in everyone. The Dodgers immediately called her and offered her a job. Major League Baseball offered her a job.
Oh, my goodness.
She got offers of scholarship. She signed on to work for MajorLeagueBaseball.com through the Dodgers. And so what she does now is she writes a weekly column for MLB.com on the Dodger website and gets paid. That's kind of her living now, and that's how she makes a little living, and it is amazing.
Glenn, this is obviously a very unusual piece. Did you know from the outset that it would lead the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those stories that when you first start reading it, just like Bill kind of got hooked in by this email correspondence, he hooks you in as a writer. letting that unfold before you. And at the end of the day, you're hooked into the story just as he was hooked in to Sarah Morris. And, you know, I often say that I pick stories for the book because I want to read them again. And this is certainly one that I want to read again. But it also set up sort of like a new criteria, because every time I read this story, and I've probably read it 20 times, I start to tear up. And I've read it 20 times. And that's, you know, something pretty remarkable, because I get inundated with stories about people who are athletes with cancer or, you know, some other problem or something. And I become numb to those stories just as Bill becomes numb. And this story just cuts right through all of that.
Some of the other pieces in Best American Sports Writing, Glenn, are, to put it mildly, less heartening. Backyard Bloodbath, for example, is pretty grim. The topic is wrestling.
Story.
Well, see, there you go.
How did you, Glenn, how did you find that story?
Well, I don't limit my searches just to the Sports Illustrateds and the big newspapers like the Los Angeles Times. In fact, I find that a lot of the alternative press weekly newspapers, there's a lot of fine writing produced in there. They often are able to give a topic a lot more space than a mainstream publication, and they're willing to take a lot more risks. I don't think that story, for instance, would ever appear in a Sports Illustrated or even in ESPN, the magazine. It's even too risky for them.
For those who are unfamiliar with the story, the topic is backyard wrestling. These guys build their own wrestling ring, and the first sentence of the story is, "The sickly sweet smell of blood fills the dimly lit bathroom where John Uloa sits dazed on a closed toilet." Did you have the impression reading this that these guys consider themselves heroes?
Well, they've completely erased that line between the fictional wrestling they grew up with and saw on television and their own lives. They think that the stuff on TV was real, and now they duplicate it in their backyards, only they make it real.
And they really get hurt.
Oh, they wrap barbed wire around their heads. They cut each other. They hit each other with real metal chairs rather than the breakaway kind that they actually use on TV. And it's that weird kind of exalting of this fake experience that's just really strange. And you see this whole group of kids, you know, really diverging down a very dangerous path.
It is very dangerous, and the story is also, I mean, Bill, I appreciate your enjoying the story, but my feeling was that there's something very sad about it, because the parents involved say, "I can't stop them. I have no control over what they're doing."
I'm a parent of three children. That's how I saw the story. I didn't see it as a wrestling story or a sports story, but as a society story, is that these parents have lost control of their children. It's the worst of TV and violence and the imitative behavior in kids with no role models except these. Yeah, I just saw it as a stunning light on society. I thought it was just so compelling because of that. It's almost like, how did it get like this where kids are trying to hurt themselves like this?
Glenn, when you read stories, do you ever find yourself thinking, this isn't really a sports story, maybe it doesn't belong in this book, no matter how well written it is?
Well, I mean, I try never to have that conversation with myself. If I think it can remotely be considered a sports story, I throw it in the pile. That's the advantage of having a guest editor who has another set of eyes. If they want to decide that something isn't a sports story, they can make that decision. I mean, I can see people looking at Bill's story and saying, well, that's not really a sports story. And in a way, it's not. But again, I just try to use that widest possible definition. And I think once they're in the pages of the book, in between the covers, why they're there becomes apparent. If you're just looking at a story alone, it may seem as if it doesn't fit. I think Bill's story is a perfect example, because in this book, it's almost like the perfect story. Mm-hmm. I probably had more communications. Bill talked about the emails he got about the story. I got more emails and letters from people alerting me to this story than I've ever gotten for any other story over the 13 years I've been doing this book.
Another story which might as easily have made Best American Crime Writing as Best American Sports Writing is Skip Hollandsworth's piece about the death of the racehorse Alidar. But there's a great athlete at the center of that tale, which, Glenn, I gather is one reason why it qualifies, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, I consider horses at least as much athletes as human beings, sometimes even more so. And, you know, something about horse racing really seems to attract fine writing. There's a lot of space there because the horse never talks. I suppose that's part of it. And in fact, that story did make an anthology of crime writing this year as well. So
did it really?
Yeah, no surprise.
It absolutely did.
No surprise.
That's, you know, but all, it's almost like we had. I had a talk with Gay Talese, you know, the great author, and we had a long talk about writing these kinds of stories. And he said that the secret to good writing to him, and this is true in sports writing, is to write about people nobody's heard of, write about people in the shadows. Because then there's no preconceived notions about these people, or it's almost like fiction, nonfiction. It's all true, but it's to all these people who read it, they've never heard anything like this before. So as a story about the death of a racehorse or about a cross-country runner is more compelling than yet another Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods kind of story, because these are people who you can create through narrative who they are, and you can create the person. It's almost like writing fiction.
Glenn, you've been the series editor for Best American Sports Writing for 11 years now, and I wonder if you've seen changes from year to year in terms of what's coming across your desk.
Well, yeah, I have. I mean, there's such a larger number of sources now. I mean, when I started this, it was newspapers and magazines, and now it's newspapers and magazines and websites and all that kind of related material that's almost underground in some respect, because when you're writing for the web, you know, again, like an alternative paper, you have a lot more room, you have a lot more space. I'm also seeing a lot more stories written by women. That was something of a rarity, I think, when this series started. And those stories are no longer surprises to me.
Can I ask Glenn something? Do you think sports writing has gotten better or worse in the time you've been doing this?
I think it's...
Be honest now.
Well, I actually think it's gotten... The good stuff has gotten better. The bad stuff has gotten worse. I really
that's a great answer.
That's
yeah.
How I really think of it, because it's harder and harder, I think, for writers to carve out space in their publication to really write in. They're expected to write certain ways about certain things, so it's harder for them to break out. But I think the good stuff is really a lot better than it used to be. And, you know, to some extent, I hope this book has helped that a little bit by, you know, highlighting good writing and showing people that there are different ways to write about things.
Glenn, the guest editor the next time around is Buzz Bissinger, author of Friday Night Lights, one of the best-selling sports books of all time. Can we expect at least half the book to be stories about football in Texas, high school football in Texas next time around?
I think I'd be surprised if there were probably any stories about high school football in Texas, because, you know, Buzz, as you know, hasn't confined himself to writing about Texas football. He's a wonderful writer, and I, you know, fully expect that, you know, that he'll do a fine job and probably come up with a lot of surprises, like seems to happen every year.
Glenn Stout is the series editor for Houghton Mifflin's Best American Sports Writing. Glenn, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
And Bill Plaschke, one of the writers included in the collection this time around, writes for the LA Times. Bill, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you. I am so honored and flattered to be here. Thanks for having me.
The address for Sarah Morris's website is www.dodgerplace.com. You're listening to Only a Game. Two weeks ago, we featured a discussion with Stanley Weintraub, the author of a book entitled Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce. The truce, or actually several truces, which spontaneously happened in France during Christmas 1914, found German and British soldiers singing to and with each other, exchanging gifts, and playing soccer games in the mud between their trenches. Of that piece, Glenn Pollock of Omaha, Nebraska, who said he'd heard the program only because he'd fallen asleep the night before with his radio on, wrote, "Good work. I might listen to the program again if you have more features like Silent Night." Jim Meadey, who hears Only a Game on KWMU in St. Louis, wrote, "Today's show was very appropriate for the season. Your piece on World War I was especially insightful. I'd heard about the truce before, but was not aware that it included a soccer game." Jim Turnbull, who hears us on WBUR, wrote, "I don't usually get angry when I listen to your program, but I did get angry when I listened to the World War I story. Unfortunately, it reminded me of the senseless actions of our government now. and what probably will be happening in the months to come in Iraq. Several listeners asked about the music that accompanied the discussion of Silent Night. It was a song entitled Christmas in the Trenches, sung by John McCutcheon on a 1985 release entitled Winter Solstice. Not all the recent correspondence related to Silent Night. An anonymous listener who hears only a game on WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee, called to comment on some doggerel that I wrote about the potential reclamation of Pete Rose.
He shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. He shouldn't be inducted into anything except the Liars Gamblers Hall of Fame.
You can register an opinion or a complaint by visiting our website, onlyagame.org, and emailing us from there. Our address is oag@wbur.bu.edu. It's also WBUR 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Jordan's Furniture, furnishing houses and creating homes and families in partnership with Mass Adoption Resource Exchange. Information at 617-54-ADOPT. Direct Tire and Auto Service in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick, repairing cars, vans, and SUVs since 1974. Online at directtire.com. And Mount Auburn Club, Health Racket Club and Spa, celebrating more than 28 years of fitness education, support, and results. Mount Auburn Club, full of life. MountAuburnClub.com. Good morning, I'm Bob C., and in sports headlines, the Bruins and Celtics continue to have their problems. The Bruins lost to the New York Islanders 8-4 last night. It's their third loss in four games. The Bruins will be hosting Carolina at the Fleet Center tonight. Bonzi Wells scored 19 points, and Scottie Pippen racked up 17 to give the Portland Trailblazers a 108-103 victory over the Celtics. The Trailblazers have won six of their last eight games against the Celts. This spring, join NPR Scott Simon and Robert Siegel on our next Citizens of the World tour, exploring the natural wonders of Central Africa. To learn more, call 800-909-9287. The weather forecast calling for snow, sleet, or rain this morning, then snow this afternoon. Additional accumulation of 1 to 2 inches possible in the city, up to 4 inches north and west of the city, just about all rain on Cape Cod and the islands. It's windy today, coastal flood warning in effect, tides running about 2.5 feet above normal.
I'm Ted O'Brien. I hope you'll join me at a benefit for WBUR on Thursday, January 9th at the Stewart Street Playhouse in Boston. We'll enjoy a special performance of Back from Broadway, the two-man musical that features songs from hits like Fiddler on the Roof, My Fair Lady, and Carousel, and weaves them into the actors' true misadventures on their way to Broadway. Afterward, we'll get to meet the cast at a private post-show discussion where you can participate. For tickets, call 1-800-909-9287 or go to wbur.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a sport that may outrage folks opposing cruelty to vegetables. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Happy New Year, Charlie.
Happy New Year to you, Bill.
2002 was certainly a good year for wild cards, with the New England Patriots and the Anaheim Angels winning championships in their respective sports. Will 2003 be a good year for any of the NFL teams on this, the league's wild card weekend?
Looking at the, I mean, if you look at the four games, the Colts and the Jets and the Giants and the 49ers, these are terrific games if you happen to have a time machine. I mean, the 49ers and the Giants is a great game in the early 1980s. The game that is by far the most intriguing is Michael Vick, who has been the story, the celebrity slash impact story of this football season, going up to Green Bay and having to play at Green Bay at night on Saturday night. How he reacts to that most isolated and tundral of all football circumstances will go a long way towards determining the playoff situation, because if Atlanta manages to get by that game, they are going to be, as Burgess Meredith says in the Rocky movies, a very dangerous poison.
The Dallas Cowboys are not involved in the postseason, so no surprise, Jerry Jones fired Dave Campo, who presided over three straight 5-11 seasons. And this week, he gave Bill Parcells about 17 million good reasons to become his new head coach. How will the Big Tuna fare in Big D?
Two words, Bill. Blind faith. Eric Clapton, Stevie Winwood, Ginger Baker. Got along, made one album, had three pretty good cuts on it. Dissolved in a hail of egos and nasty writs within a year. A year from now, Bill, we're going to be saying that this was the most brilliant move Jerry Jones has made since he went into the oil business in Arkansas. 2 years from now, we're going to talk about what an idiot he is for ever trusting this guy. Well, there is no question in my mind that the Dallas Cowboys will be no worse than an 8-8 team next year. They will be no worse than a 10-6 team a year later. 3 years from now, we're going to wonder how anybody thought this relationship could work.
Well, interestingly, Parcells was not hired as general manager. This is something he insisted upon when he went to the Jets. Was this an oversight, or is this just a gentleman's agreement between two dubious gentlemen about the extent of Mr. Parcells' control?
It's an indication that while Jerry Jones is willing to give up some control, he's not willing to give up being a control freak. He's going to decide who plays for Bill Parcells. And Bill Parcells is going to be facing sooner or later, and probably in 2 years, as we spoke about earlier, a like it or lump it moment with this guy.
The Bowls are over. Thank goodness we now have a BCS champ. Aside from last night's Fiesta Bowl, how would you rate the bowl season?
The bowl season became a lemon as the year turned.
That's a very clever lemon is orange and rosy.
Thank you. No, I mean, the Rose Bowl was probably the most anticipated game of the season. It turned into a rout because Carson Palmer proved why he deserved the Heisman Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw the best bowl game of the season. I watched, for reasons that we need not go into here lest mental health professionals are listening, every down of the Mainstay Independence Bowl in which Eli Manning and the University of Mississippi beat Nebraska, thereby giving Nebraska its first three-game losing streak since 1961.
Heads will roll.
Heads will roll in Lincoln. But it was a 27-23 game. Eli Manning put on a tremendous performance. Nebraska showed that they probably won't lose three games in a row next year. And it was very entertaining. And for me, that's all bowl season has ever been about. As you know, I'm perfectly willing to go back to the days where no bowl had a sponsor and we decided the national champion or national champions by having 8 or 9 bowls so all could win and all could have prizes.
Mm-hmm.
Since we seem to be heading in the other direction, I'm going to hang on to my little bowl games as long as I can.
Houston Rockets center Yao Ming, fourth overall in the balloting for the NBA's All-Star game. He's doing pretty well for himself.
It's a great story. It is the best story to hit the NBA since Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. The guy can really play. He's entertaining. It is hilarious to watch the other guys in the Rockets learn to cope with this guy, where you see them on the bench and they're all laughing. And while I am told that Yao's English is better than he lets on, you still have to wonder exactly how much gets lost in the conversational chasm. But they all seem to be having a wonderful time with the guy.
The Shanghai Sharks have decided to retire number 15, which Yao Ming wore when he played in Shanghai. Yao Ming was happy, of course, at this honor, though I understand he did find a downside in this development.
Yeah, his father wore number 15 when he was a player, and Yao wanted his son to wear number 15. This is tragic. I like the notion that he's the first athlete in Chinese history to have his jersey number retired. We're talking a lot of athletes here. This isn't like being the first Liechtensteiner to have your number retired. We're talking billions and billions of athletes here.
Among the many records that Wayne Gretzky set was greatest number of points scored against the Nashville Predators in a single game. And the record was 5. And Peter Forsberg of the Colorado Avalanche broke that record Tuesday night with a goal and 5 assists. Why does anybody bother with this sort of statistic?
Well, this should give you an indication of how they're still sort of learning things down in Nashville about this whole NHL business. It was the Predators who publicized this. Look, Wayne Gretzky's record was broken in our building.
Against us.
That's right. We're so proud.
Finally, Charlie, here's an intriguing new competitive possibility. Two Irishmen are set to become the first people to cross the Antarctic on sleds pulled by kites. Sounds perfect for the Winter X Games when they move to the Antarctic. What do you think?
Yes, and all over the Antarctic, dogs are going, yes, 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 kites, great idea. Yes, I'm looking through the story, Bill, and I don't see the word Guinness anywhere in there, but I suspect they're involved if only as a sponsor.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and glides nimbly through my questions each week here at Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Nimble, nimble, nimble. Thank you, Bill.
It was our distinct and giddy privilege to attend Bill Parcells' Foxborough press conferences as often as we liked, from 1993 to 1997, during which time the Biggest Tuna transformed the laughable New England Patriots into a Super Bowl contender. Parcells' comments ranged from weird to wise, from ill-advised to absolutely wonderful. We compiled the following audio tribute to Bill Parcells in 1995, and we reprise it today because in some strange way, his words seem truer now than they were 8 years ago.
Football's a little bit more like an orchestra. If you like football, you're going to like this. If you just kind of like it, you're not going to like it. If you don't like it at all, you're going to hate it. I'm not trying to be poetic here. We do a lot of stupid things. And this is football. You know, you bump into guys. Great game, this National Football League. I don't know whether that's official or not, but it's an unofficial official. Want to trade jobs, Hobson? I've always been an advocate of the two-day week myself. The week before, were you here for that one? That wasn't what you call a Picasso, okay? We may well not win another game. I don't know. But we might. Who knows? It really is fun to watch. Just watch them. You know, it's funny. Funny things happen. I'm not stupid. I mean, in that respect, I'm stupid in a lot of respects, but not that one. Hey, you got kids crying, and they're so happy they're crying. Hey, I'm not sentimental, believe me. The great whites are circling. They just envelop, they just gulp you down. If it was good for you, it was good for me. It's been fun, but I'm going to the bunker. See you later.
The wit, wisdom, and weirdness of former New York Giants, New England Patriots, New York Jets, and current Dallas Cowboys head coach Bill Parcells. Staying warm, active, and alert through the winter months is a challenge for everyone not residing in warmer climes. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein recently journeyed to a corner of upstate New York to witness this phenomenon playing itself out in a most unusual way, and he has this report.
In his children's book Rutabaga Stories, author Carl Sandburg writes, "Welcome to Rutabaga Country, where the railroad tracks go from straight to zigzag. This is Rutabaga Country, the farmer's market in Ithaca, New York. It's a chilly late December day. Still, people are lined up to register for the fifth annual Rutabaga Curl.
65.
Number 65, that's a good number for Rutabaga.
That's the winning number.
Contestants pay a buck, get a number, and then choose from a bin full of purplish cousins of the turnip and the cabbage. Curlers are allowed to make minor adjustments to their rutabaga. Ellie Hobby hacks at hers with a knife.
I'm trimming the ends off my rutabaga to make it more aerodynamic, isn't the word, but more rollable.
Rutabaga curling bears little resemblance to the Canadian sport involving ice, stones, and brooms. It's more of a cross between bowling and shuffleboard. Here's how it works. You roll the rutabaga down the wooden market floor to a small blue circle 79 feet away. The closest rutabaga to the target wins.
Hi. Can I sign up?
Yes, you may.
The brains behind the sport and the commissioner of the International Rutabaga Curling Federation is Steve Searick, a middle-aged guy with a sly smile. He's a greeting card vendor at the market. It all began 6 years ago, he says, on an especially bitter day with scant customers. Some of the vendors started getting bored.
Just trying to keep warm, just jumping up and down. Turned to crazy winter sports like curling. And we realized that nobody knew the rules.
So they just started rolling stuff.
Turnips and potatoes and even a frozen chicken. They were all getting big laughs. There was a cabbage. I remember a cabbage going down the floor. And in fact, that was my particular choice. I threw a cabbage and it was shedding its leaves as it was going down the floor.
But it was the tumbles of the rutabaga that got the most laughs. Over the winter, Searick codified rules and rutabaga curling was born.
Is that the rutabaga world champion?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my gosh. I never thought I'd meet him.
On the practice court, defending world champion James Neidhart warms up.
So the most important thing about rutabaga hurling is the visualization and transferring that visualization into the action of hurling the rutabaga. It's more of a push than a hurl, though. First thing I do is line up my rutabaga. I take my spot, which is about 6 inches off center, keep my eye on the spot, and just slowly push it. That was way off the mark.
There's still more time to practice, as 75 curlers, young and old, stand around bundled in parkas and polar fleece. They cradle their rutabagas like infants and await the arrival of the rutabaga queen.
The torch from Mount Cruciferous, and now the beginning of the 5th annual rutabaga curling championships is about to begin.
With a pine bow crown and a torch made of, yes, a rutabaga, the rutabaga queen jogs into the market. Competitors fall in step for the annual parade and thrust their rutabagas high over their heads. Marissa Iacobucci and Joe Caruso gawk from the sidelines and try to make sense of it all.
We're trying to figure that out.
Yeah, maybe that's the part
it's
of the
It's one of those Ithacan things, you know, where people get together and do these sort of esoteric things.
It's community. It's a sense of community. It makes it fun.
The president of the local Chamber of Commerce rolls out the first rutabaga. And finally, the first curler steps up to the line.
Root, root, root.
A couple hundred spectators line the court. Play is half sport, half theater. The referees run around like Keystone Cops. There's the guy who tries to throw a black radish disguised as a rutabaga. There's the ethical treatment of rutabaga protesters. And there's the rutabaga cheerleaders.
The cheerleaders have arrived.
There are three qualifying rounds. The 9 best curls advance to the finals. Each curler gets just one roll. The rutabaga is an unpredictable sort of vegetable. An average curl looks right on target at first, then tends to wobble off course.
Number 58.
Founder Steve Searick calls this the great leveler of the sport.
You really can't control your rutabaga that much. So it takes sort of the athletic element out of it, to the point that almost anybody, even if somebody's brand new to the sport, they can actually do pretty well.
In fact, no one has won the championship twice. And after the last tuber rumbles down the court, the winner is 8-year-old David Tregaskis. Amid camera flashes and adoring fans at the medal ceremony, he clutches his victorious rutabaga with one hand. He munches on a candy cane with the other and dispenses rutabaga wisdom.
Kind of trickles that to roll it not very far, because then people are just rolling it really far over past years.
We'll see you next year
At the sixth annual international...
As the ceremony concludes, Commissioner Seerig stands to the side and savors every last minute of the fun.
During this competition, I've seen people who are usually pretty stone-faced and pretty serious, and I've seen them break out into the biggest laughs. It's kind of this playful spirit that human beings still have even as adults.
Ithacans hope that spirit will help dispel the darkness of the season until the days grow longer. Meanwhile, Commissioner Seerig will look for ways to spread the joy of the rutabaga around the world. The next step, he says with a sly smile, is inclusion in the Olympics. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein in Ithaca, New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or witness honest-to-goodness rutabaga curling, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from International Rutabaga Curling Federation Commissioner Steve Sirik, who discussed a variation on the game over which he presides.
The frozen chicken was very funny, and it had a handle sort of like a curling stone would. We only did that one once.
I would think once would be enough, and I'm sure the chicken would agree. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you feel better when you send us in your letter and tell us the name of your favorite vegetable.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.
Public Radio.
This is WBUR.